the face at the same time. The two shuddered to a stop, and the chain-fisted man fell over into Wolfgar's arms. The barbarian brushed him aside to land heavily, face down, far, far from consciousness. The blow had hurt Wolfgar badly, he knew, for his vision spun and blurred, and he had to keep reminding himself where he was. He got an arm up suddenly, but only partially deflected a flying chair, one leg spinning around to poke him hard in the forehead, which only heightened his dizziness. The fight around him was slowing now, for more men were down and groaning than still standing and punching. But Wolfgar needed another reprieve, a temporary one at least. He took the only route apparent to him, rushing to the bar and rolling over it, landing on his feet behind the barricade. He landed face to face with Aram Gardpek.
"Oh, but ye've done a wonderful thing this night now, haven't ye?"
Aram spat at him.
"A fight every night for Wolfgar, or it's not a fun one."
Wolfgar grabbed the man by the front of his tunic. He pulled him up roughly from his crouch behind the bar, lifted him with ease, and slammed him hard against the back wall above the bottle shelving, destroying more than a bit of expensive stock in the process.
"Be glad your face is not at the end of my fist,"
the unrepentant barbarian growled.
"Or more. Be glad ye've not toyed with me own emotions the way ye've burned poor Delhi,"
Aram growled right back. His words hurt Wolfgar profoundly, for he had no answers to Aram's accusation, could not rightly argue that he had no blame where Delhi Curti was involved. Wolfgar gave Aram a little jerk, then set him down and took a step back, glaring at the tavern keeper unblinkingly. He noticed a movement to the side, and he glanced over to see a huge, disembodied fist hovering in the air above the bar. Wolfgar was hit on the side of the head, harder than he ever remembered being struck. He reeled, grabbing another shelf of potent whiskey and pulling it down, then staggered and spun, grabbing the bar for support. Across from him, Josie Puddles spat in his face. Before Wolfgar could respond, he noted the magical floating hand coming at him hard from the side. He was hit again, and his legs went weak. He was hit yet again, lifted right from his feet and slammed hard into the back wall. All the world was spinning, and he felt as if he were sinking into the floor. He was half-carried, half-dragged, out from behind the bar and across the floor, all the fighting coming to an abrupt end at the sight of mighty Wolfgar finally defeated.
"Finish it outside,"
Reef said, kicking open the door. Even as the man turned for the street, he found a dagger point at his throat. "It's already finished," Morik casually explained, though he betrayed his calm by glancing back inside toward the thin wizard, who was packing up his things, apparently unconcerned by any of this. Reef had hired him as a bit of insurance. Since the wizard apparently held no personal stake in the brawl, the rogue calmed a bit and muttered under his breath, "I hate wizards." He turned his attention back to Reef and dug the knife in a bit more. Reef looked to his companion, holding Wolfgar's other arm, and together they unceremoniously threw the barbarian into the mud. Wolfgar climbed back to his feet, sheer willpower alone forcing him back into a state of readiness. He turned back toward the closed door, but Morik was there, grabbing his arm. "Don't," the rogue commanded. "They don't want you in there. What will you prove?" Wolfgar started to argue, but he looked Morik in the eye and saw no room for debate. He knew the rogue was right. He knew that he had no home. Chapter 4 A Lady's Life.
"Ganderlei," Temegast announced, as he entered the room to join Priscilla and Feringal. Both looked at the steward curiously, not understanding.
"The woman you saw, my lord Feringal," Temegast explained. "Her family name is Ganderlei." "I know of no Ganderleis in Orkney," Priscilla argued. "There are few families in the village whose names are familiar to you, my dear lady,"
Temagast replied, his tone somewhat dry.
But this woman is indeed a Ganderlay. She lives with her family on the south slope of Merlin Mountain, he explained,
referring to a fairly populated region of Orkney, some 2 miles from the castle, on a step-carved mountainside facing the harbor.
Girl, Priscilla corrected condescendingly. She's nowhere near to being a woman.
Farringall didn't even seem to hear the comment, too excited by the steward's news.
Are you certain?
He asked Temagast, jumping up and striding determinedly to stand right before the man.
Can it be?
The woman was walking the road at the same time your coach rolled through,
the steward confirmed.
She matches the description given by several people who know her and saw her on the road at the time. They all mentioned her striking long black hair, which matches your own description of her, my lord. I am certain she is the eldest daughter of one Donny Ganderlay.
I'll go to her,
Farringall announced, pacing back and forth eagerly, tapping one finger to his teeth, then turning fast and then again, as if he didn't know where to go or what to do.
I will call the coach.
My lord Farringall,
Temagast said quietly, in a commanding tone that seemed to steady the eager young man.
That would be most inappropriate.
Farringall stared at him wide-eyed.
But why?
Because she is a peasant and not worthy of—
Priscilla began, but her voice trailed off, for it was obvious that no one was listening to her.
One does not go unannounced to the house of a proper lady, Temagast explained. The way must be prepared by your steward and her father.
But I am the Lord of Orkney,
Farringall protested. I can—
You can do as you like if you desire her as a plaything,
Temagast was quick to interrupt, drawing a frown from both Farringall and Priscilla.
But if you desire her as a wife proper, then arrange things properly. There is a way, my lord Farringall, a manner in which we are all expected to act. To go against the etiquette in this matter could prove most disastrous, I assure you.
I don't understand.
Of course you don't, Temagast said. But I do. Fortunately for us all. Now go and bathe. If the young Ganderlay Doe stood downwind of you, she would run away.
With that he turned Lord Farringall toward the door and gave him a solid push to start him on his way.
You have betrayed me,
Priscilla wailed when her brother was gone. Temagast snorted at the ridiculous assertion.
I'll not have her in this house,
the woman said determinedly.
Have you not come to realize that there's nothing short of murder you can do to stop it?
Temagast replied in all seriousness.
The murder of your brother, I mean, not of the girl, for that would only invite Farringall's wrath upon you.
But you have aided him in this foolish pursuit.
I have provided only what he could have learned on his own by asking questions of any peasant, including 3 women who work in this very house, one of whom was on the road yesterday.
If the fool even noticed them,
Priscilla argued.
He would have discovered the girl's name, insisted Temagast,
and he might have embarrassed us all in the process of his undignified hunt.
The steward chuckled and moved very close to Priscilla, draping one arm across her shoulders.
"I understand your concerns, dear Priscilla," he said, "and I don't entirely disagree with you. I, too, would have preferred your brother to fall in love with some wealthy merchant girl from another place rather than with a peasant of Orkney. Or for him to forget the concept of love altogether and merely give in to his lust when and where it suited him without taking a wife. Perhaps it will yet come to that.
Less likely, now that you have so aided him,
Priscilla said sharply.
Not so, Temagast explained with a wide smile,
one that caught Priscilla's attention, for her expression changed to intrigue.
All I have done is heightened your brother's trust in me and my judgments. Perhaps he will hold fast to his notion of loving this girl, of marrying her. But I will watch him every step, I promise. I'll not allow him to bring shame to Family Orc, nor will I allow the girl and her family to take from us what they do not deserve. We cannot defeat his will in this, I assure you, and your indignation will only strengthen Feringel's resolve.
Priscilla snorted doubtfully.
Can't you hear his anger when you berate him about this? Temegast demanded, and she winced at his words. If we distance ourselves from your brother now, I warn you, the Ganderlay girl's hold over him, over Orkney, will only heighten.
Priscilla didn't snort, didn't shake her head, didn't show any sign of disagreement. She just stared at Temegast long and hard. He kissed her on the cheek and moved away, thinking that he should summon the castle coach at once and be on with his duties as emissary of Lord Feringel. Jackus Schooley looked up from the field of mud along with all the other workers, human and gnome, as the decorated coach made its way along the dirt lane. It came to a stop in front of Donny Ganderlay's small house. An old man climbed out of the carriage door and ambled toward the house. Jackus' eyes narrowed slightly. Remembering suddenly that others might be watching him, he resumed his typically distant air. He was Jackus Schooley, after all, the fantasy lover of every young lady in Orkney, especially the woman who lived in the house where the lord's carriage had stopped. The notion that beautiful Miralda desired him was no small thing to the young man, though of course he couldn't let anyone else believe he cared.
"Tony!"
one of the other field workers, a crooked little gnome with a long and pointy nose, called.
"Donny Ganderlay, you've got guests. Or it mightn't be they figured you for the scoundrel you are,"
another gnome cried out, and they all had a good laugh. Except for Jacka, of course. Jacka wouldn't let them see him laugh. Donny Ganderlay walked over the ridge behind the peat field. He looked to those who yelled for some explanation, but they merely nodded their chins in the direction of his house. Donny followed that movement, spotted the coach, and broke into a frantic run. Jackus Schooley watched him run all the way home.
"You figuring to do some digging, boy?"
came a question beside Jacka. When he turned to regard the toothless old man, the fool ran a hand through Jacka's curly brown hair. The young man shook his head with disgust, noting the black peat encasing the old digger's fingers. He shook his head again and brushed his hair robustly, then slapped the man's hand away when it reached up to give another rub.
"Hee-hee-hee,"
the old man giggled.
"Seems your little girlie's got a collar,"
he snickered.
"And an old one at that,"
remarked another, also more than willing to join in the play at Jacka's expense.
"But I'm thinking I might give the girl a try meself,"
the dirty old duffer at Jacka's side remarked. That drew a frown from Jacka, and so the old man only laughed all the harder at finally evoking some response from the boy. Jacka turned his head slowly around, surveying the field and the workers, the few houses scattered on the mountainside, Castle Auk far in the distance, and the dark, cold waters beyond that. Those waters had brought him, his mother, and his uncle to this forlorn place only 4 years before. Jacka didn't know why they had come to Orkney. He had been quite content with his life in Luskin, except that it had something to do with his father, who used to beat his mother mercilessly. He suspected that they were running, either from the man or from the executioner. It seemed to be a typical tactic for the Schooley family, for they had done the same thing when Jacka was a toddler, fleeing from their ancestral home in the Blade Kingdoms all the way to Luskin. Certainly his father, a vicious man whom Jacka hardly knew, would search them out and kill his mother and her brother for running away. Or perhaps Jacka's father was already dead, left in his own blood by Rampini, Jacka's uncle. Either way, it didn't matter to Jacka. All that he knew was that he was in this place, a dreadful, windy, cold, and barren fiefdom. Until recently, the only good thing about it, in his view, was that the perpetual melancholy of the place enhanced his poetic nature. Even though he fancied himself quite the romantic hero, Jacka had passed his 17th birthday now, and had many times considered tagging along with one of the few merchants who happened through, going out into the wide world, back to Luskin perhaps, or even better, all the way to mighty Waterdeep. He planned to make his fortune there someday, somehow, and perhaps get all the way back to the Blade Kingdoms. But those plans had been put on hold, for yet another positive aspect of Orkney had revealed itself to the young man. Jacka could not deny the attraction he felt to a certain young Ganderlay girl. Of course, he couldn't let her or anyone else know that, not until he was certain that she would give herself over to him fully. Hurrying past the coach, Donny Ganderlay recognized the driver, a gray-bearded gnome he knew as Liam Woodgate. Liam smiled and nodded at him, which relaxed Donny considerably, though he still kept his swift pace through the door. At his small kitchen table sat the steward of Castle Auk. Across from him was Donny's ill wife, Beasta, whose beaming expression the peat farmer hadn't seen in a long, long time.
"Master Ganderlay,"
Temegast said politely.
"I am Temegast, steward of Castle Auk, emissary of Lord Feringal."
"I know that," Donny said warily.
Never taking his eyes from the old man, Donny Ganderlay made his way around the table, avoiding one of the two remaining chairs to stand behind his wife, dropping his hands on her shoulders.
"I was just explaining to your wife that my lord, and yours, requests the presence of your eldest daughter at the castle for dinner this evening," the steward said.
The startling news hit Donny Ganderlay as solidly as any club ever could, but he held his balance and his expression, letting it sink in. He looked behind the words into Temegast's old gray eyes.
"Of course. I have suitable clothing for Miss Miralda in the coach, should you agree?"
Temegast finished with a comforting smile. Proud Donny Ganderlay saw behind that smiling facade, behind the polite and respectful tone. He saw the condescension there, and recognized the confidence within Temegast. Of course they could not refuse, Temegast believed, for they were but dirty peasants. The Lord of Orkney had come a-calling, and the Ganderlays would welcome that call eagerly, hungrily.
"Where is Miralda?"
the man asked his wife.
"She and Tory have gone to trading,"
the woman explained. Donny couldn't ignore the weak trembling in her voice.
"To get a few eggs for supper."
"Miralda can eat at a banquet this night, and perhaps for many nights,"
Temegast remarked. Donny saw it so clearly again, the wretched condescension that reminded him of his lot in life, of the fate of his children, all his friends and their children as well.
"Then she will come?"
Temegast prompted after a long and uncomfortable silence.
"That'll be Miralda's to choose,"
Donny Ganderlay replied more sharply than he had intended.
"Ah,"
said the steward, nodding and smiling, always smiling. He rose from his chair and motioned for Beasta to remain seated.
"Of course, of course. But do come and retrieve the gown, Master Ganderlay. Should you decide to send the young lady, it will be better and easier if she had it here."
"And if she doesn't want to go?"
Temegast arched a brow, suggesting he thought the notion that she might refuse absurd.
"Then I will have my coachman return tomorrow to retrieve the gown, of course," he said.
Donny looked down at his ill wife, at the plaintive expression on her too delicate features.
"Master Ganderlay?"
Temegast asked, motioning for the door. Donny patted Beasta on the shoulders and walked beside the steward out to the coach. The gnome driver was waiting for them, gown in hand, and his arms uplifted to keep the delicate fabric from dragging in the dusty road.
"You would do well to urge your daughter to attend," Temegast advised, handing over the gown, which only made Doni Ganderlay steel his features all the more. "Your wife is sick," Temegast reasoned. "No doubt a meager existence in a drafty house will not do her well with a cold winter approaching."
"You speak as if we've a choice in the matter," Doni replied.
"Lord Feringhal is a man of great means," Temegast explained. "He has easy access to amazing herbs, warm beds, and powerful clerics. It would be a pity for your wife to suffer needlessly."
The steward patted the gown.
"We shall dine just after sundown," he explained. "I will have the coach pass by your home at dusk."
With that, Temegast stepped into the coach and closed the door. The driver wasted no time in putting whip to horses to speed them away. Doni Ganderlay stood for a long while in the cloud of dust left by the departing coach, gown in hand, staring at the empty air before him. He wanted to scream out that if Lord Feringhal was such a connected and beneficent lord, then he should willingly use his means for the welfare of his flock. People like Beasta Ganderlay should be able to get the aid they needed without selling their daughters. What Temegast had just offered him was akin to selling his daughter for the benefit of the family, selling his daughter. And yet, for all his pride, Doni Ganderlay could not deny the opportunity that lay before him.
"It was the Lord's coach,"
Jacka Schooley insisted to Miralda when he intercepted her on her way home later that same day.
"At your own front door,"
he added with his exotic accent, a dialect thick with sighs and dramatic huffs. Tori Ganderlay giggled. Miralda punched her in the shoulder and motioned for her to be on her way.
"But I want to know,"
she whined.
"You'll be knowing the taste of dirt,"
Miralda promised her. She started for her sister, but stopped abruptly and composed herself, remembering her audience. Miralda turned back to Jacka after painting a sweet smile on her face, still managing to glare at Tori out of the corner of her eye. Tori started skipping down the road.
"But I wanted to see you kiss him,"
she squealed happily as she ran on.
"Are you sure about the coach?"
Miralda asked Jacka, trying very hard to leave Tori's embarrassing remarks behind. The young man merely sighed with dramatic exasperation.
"But what business has Lord Feringhal with my folks?"
the young woman asked. Jacka hung his head to the side, hands in pockets, and shrugged.
"Well, I should be going then,"
Miralda said, and she took a step, but Jacka shifted to block her way.
"What are you about?"
Jacka looked at her with those light blue eyes, running a hand through his mop of curly hair, his face tilted up at her. Miralda felt as if she would choke for the lump that welled in her throat, or that her heart would beat so forcefully that it would pound right out of her chest.
"What are you about?"
she asked again, much more quietly and without any real conviction. Jacka moved toward her. She remembered her own advice to Tori about how one had to make a boy beg. She reminded herself that she should not be doing this, not yet. She told herself that pointedly, and yet she was not retreating at all. He came closer, and as she felt the heat of his breath, she too moved forward. Jacka just let his lips brush hers, then backed away, appearing suddenly shy.
"What?"
Miralda asked again, this time with obvious eagerness. Jacka sighed, and the woman came forward again, moving to kiss him, her whole body trembling, begging him to kiss her back. He did, long and soft, Then he moved away.
"I'll be waiting for you after supper," he said.
And he turned with a shrug and started slowly away. Meralda could hardly catch her breath, for that kiss had been everything she had dreamed it would be and more. She felt warm in her belly and weak in her knees and tingly all over. Never mind that Jacka, with one simple hesitation, had done to her exactly what she had told Tori a woman must do to a man. Meralda couldn't even think of that at the time. Too entranced was she by the reality of what had just happened and by the promise of what might happen next. She took the same path down the road Tori had taken, and her skipping was no less full of the girlish joy, as if Jacka's kiss had freed her of the bonds of temperance and dignity that came with being a woman. Meralda entered her house all smiles. Her eyes widened when she saw her sick mother standing by the table, as happy as she had seen the woman in 10 days. Biasta held a beautiful gown, rich emerald green with glittering gems sewn into its seams.
"Oh, but you'll be the prettiest Orkney's ever seen when you put this on,"
Biasta Ganderlay said, and beside her Tori exploded in giggles. Meralda stared at the gown wide-eyed, then turned to regard her father, who was standing at the side of the room, smiling as well. Meralda recognized that his expression was somewhat more strained than Biasta's.
"But, Ma, we've not the coin,"
Meralda reasoned, though she was truly enchanted by the gown. She moved up to stroke the soft material, thinking how much Jacka would love to see her in it.
"A gift, and nothing to buy,"
Biasta explained, and Tori giggled all the more. Meralda's expression turned to one of curiosity, and she looked to her father again for some explanation, but, surprisingly, he turned away.
"What's it about, Ma?"
the young woman asked.
"You've a suitor, my girl,"
Biasta said happily, pulling the gown out so that she could hug her daughter.
"Oh, but you've got a lord hisself wanting to court you."
Always considerate of her mother's feelings, especially now that the woman was ill, Meralda was glad that Biasta's head was on Meralda's shoulder, so her mother couldn't see the stunned and unhappy expression that crossed her daughter's face. Tori did see it, but the girl only looked up at Meralda and pursed her lips repeatedly in a mockery of a kiss. Meralda looked to her father, who now faced her but only nodded solemnly. Biasta pulled her back to arm's length.
"Oh, my little girl," she said, "when did you get so beautiful? To think that you've caught the heart of Lord Feringal."
Lord Feringal. Meralda could hardly catch her breath, and not for any joy. She hardly knew the Lord of Castleok, though she had seen him on many occasions from afar, usually picking his fingernails and looking bored at the celebratory gatherings held in the town square.
"He's sweet on you, girl," Biasta went on, "and in it thick by the words of his steward."
Meralda managed a smile for her mother's sake.
"They'll be coming for you soon," Biasta explained, "so be quick to get a bath, then," she added,
pausing to bring one hand up to her mouth.
"Then we'll put you in this gown, and oh, how all the men who see you will fall before your feet."
Meralda moved methodically, taking the gown and turning for her room with Tori on her heels. It all seemed a dream to the young woman, and not a pleasant one. Her father walked past her to her mother. She heard them strike up a conversation, though the words seemed all garbled to her, and the only thing she truly heard was Biasta's exclamation,
"A lord for my girl!"
Orkney was not a large place, and though its houses weren't cluttered together, the folk were certainly within shouting distance of each other. It didn't take long for word of the arrangement between Lord Feringal and Meralda Ganderlay to spread. Jackasculi learned the truth about the visit of Lord Farangal's steward before he finished eating that same evening, before the sun touched the western horizon. "To think one of his station will dip low enough to touch the likes of a peasant," Jacka's ever-pessimistic mother remarked, her voice still thick with the heavy peasant accent of their long-lost homeland in the Blade Kingdoms. "Ah, to the ruin of all the world!"
"Evil tiding,"
Jacka's uncle agreed, a grizzled old man who appeared to have seen too much of the world. Jacka, too, thought this a terrible turn of events, but for a very different reason. At least he thought his anger had come from a different source, for he wasn't certain of the reason his mother and uncle were so upset by the news, and his expression clearly revealed that confusion.
"We've each our station," his uncle explained. "Clear lines and not to be crossed."
"Lord Feringel brings dishonor to his family," said his mother. "Meralt is a wonderful woman,"
Jacka argued, before he could catch and hold the word secret.
"She's a peasant, as we all be,"
his mother was quick to explain.
"We've our place, and Lord Feringel's got his. All them folk will rejoice at the news, do not doubt, thinking to draw some of their own hope at Meralda's good fortunes, but they're not knowing the truth of it."
"What truth?"
"He'll use her to no good ends," foretold his mother. "He'll make himself the fool and the girl a tramp.
And in the end she'll be broken or dead, and Lord Feringel will have lost all favor with his peers," added his uncle. "Evil tiding."
"Why do you believe that she will succumb?"
the young man asked, working hard to keep the desperation out of his tone. His mother and uncle merely laughed at that question. Jacka understood their meaning all too clearly. Feringel was the Lord of Orkney. How could Meralda refuse him? It was more than poor, sensitive Jacka could take. He banged the table hard with his fist and slid his chair back. Rising fast to his feet, he matched the surprised stares of his mother and uncle with a glower of utter rage. With that, Jacka turned on his heel and rushed out, slamming the door behind him. Before he knew it, he was running, his thoughts whirling. Jacka soon came to high ground, a small tumble of rocks just above the muddy field he had been working earlier that same day, a place affording him a splendid view of the sunset, as well as Meralda's house. In the distant southwest, he saw the castle, and he pictured the magnificent coach making its deliberate way up the road to it with Meralda inside. Jacka felt as if a heavy weight were pressing on his chest, as if all the limitations of his miserable existence had suddenly become tangible walls, closing, closing. For the last few years, Jacka had gone to great lengths to acquire just the correct persona, the correct pose, and the correct attitude to turn the heart of any young lady. Now here came this foolish nobleman, this prettily painted and perfumed fop with no claim to reputation other than the station to which he had been born, to take all that Jacka had cultivated right out from under him. Jacka, of course, didn't see things with quite that measure of clarity. To him it seemed a plain enough truth, a grave injustice played against him simply because of the station, or lack thereof, of his birth. Because these pitiful peasants of Orkney didn't know the truth of him, the greatness that lay within him, hidden by the dirt of farm fields and peat bogs. The distraught young man ran his hands through his brown locks and heaved a great sigh.
"You best get it all cleaned, because you're not knowing what Lord Feringel will be seeing,"
Tori teased, and she ran a rough cloth across Meralda's back, as her sister sat like a cat, curled up in the steaming hot bath. Meralda turned at the words and splashed water in Tori's face. The younger girl's giggles halted abruptly when she noted the grim expression on Meralda's face.
"I'm knowing what Lord Feringel will be seeing, all right,"
Meralda assured her sister.
"If he's wanting his dress back, he'll have to be coming back to the house to get it." "You'd refuse him?" "I won't even kiss him,"
Meralda insisted. and she lifted a dripping fist into the air.
If he tries to kiss me,
You'll play the part of a lady, came the voice of her father. Both girls looked to the curtain to see the man enter the room. Leave, he instructed Tori. The girl knew that tone well enough to obey without question. Donny Ganderlay stayed at the door a moment longer to make sure that too curious Tori had indeed scooted far away. Then he moved to the side of the tub and handed Miralda a soft cloth to dry herself. They lived in a small house where modesty was pointless, so Miralda was not the least bit embarrassed as she stepped from her bath, though she draped the cloth around her before she sat on a nearby stool.
"You're not happy about the turn of events?"
Donny observed. Miralda's lips grew thin, and she leaned over to splash a nervous hand in the cold bath water.
"You don't like Lord Farringall?"
"I don't know him,"
the young woman retorted.
"And he's not knowing me. Not at all."
"But he's wanting to," Donny argued. "You should take that as the highest compliment."
"And taking a compliment means giving in to the one complimenting?"
Miralda asked with biting sarcasm.
"I've no choice in the matter. Lord Farringall's wanting you, so off you go."
Her nervous splashing of water turned angry, and she accidentally sent a small wave washing over Donny Ganderlay. The young woman understood that it was not the wetness, but the attitude that provoked his unexpectedly violent reaction. He caught her wrist in his strong hand and tugged it back, turning Miralda toward him.
"No," he answered bluntly. "You've no choice. Farringall is the Lord of Orkney, a man of great means, a man who can lift us from the dirt."
"Maybe I'd rather be dirty,"
Miralda started to say, but Donny Ganderlay cut her short.
"A man who can heal your mother."
He could not have stunned her more with the effect of those 7 words than if he had curled his great fist into a tight ball and punched Miralda hard in the face. She stared at her father incredulously, at the desperate, almost wild expression on his normally stoic face, and she was afraid, truly afraid.
"You've no choice,"
he said again, his voice a forced monotone.
"Your ma's got the wilting, and won't likely see the next turn of spring. You'll go to Lord Farringall and play the part of a lady. You'll laugh at his wit and you'll praise his greatness. This you'll do for your ma."
He finished simply, his voice full of defeat. As he turned away and rose, Miralda caught a glint of moisture rimming his eye, and she understood. Knowing how truly horrible this was for her father did help the young woman prepare for the night, helped greatly to cope with this seemingly cruel twist that fate had thrown before her. The sun was down, and the sky was turning dark blue. The coach passed below him on the way to Miralda's meager house. She stepped from the door, and even from this great distance, Jacka could see how beautiful she appeared, like some shining jewel that mocked the darkness of twilight. His jewel. The just reward for the beauty that was within him, not a bought present for the spoiled Lord of Orkney. He pictured Lord Farringall holding his hand out of the coach, touching her and fondling her as she stepped inside to join him. The image made him want to scream out at the injustice of it all. The coach rolled back down the road toward the distant castle with Miralda inside, just as he had envisioned earlier. Jacka could not have felt more robbed if Lord Farringall had reached into his pockets and taken his last coin. He sat wallowing on the peat-dusted hill for a long, long while, running his hands through his hair repeatedly and cursing the inequities of this miserable life. So self-involved was he that he was taken completely by surprise by the sudden sound of a young girl's voice.
"I knew you'd be about."
Jacka opened his dreamy, moist eyes to see Tori Ganderlay staring at him.
"I knew it,"
the girl teased. What do you know?
You heard about my sister's dinner and had to see for yourself,
Tori reasoned.
And you're still waiting and watching.
Your sister? Jacka repeated dumbly. I come here every night, he explained. Tori turned from him to gaze down at the houses, at her own house, the firelight shining bright through the window.
Hoping to see Meralda naked through the window?
She asked with a giggle. I come out alone in the dark to get away from the fires and the light, Jacka replied firmly. To get away from pestering people who cannot understand.
Understand what?
The truth, the young man answered cryptically, hoping he sounded profound.
The truth of what?
The truth of life, Jacka replied. Tori looked at him long and hard, her face twisting as she tried to decipher his words. She looked back to her house.
Bah, I'm thinking you're just wanting to see Meralda naked,
she said again, then skipped happily back down the path. Wouldn't she have fun with Meralda at his expense, Jacka thought. He heaved another of his great sighs, then turned and walked away to the even darker fields higher up the mountainside. "Fy this life!" he cried out, lifting his arms to the rising full moon. "Fy! Fy and fly from me now, trappings mortal! What cruel fate to live and to see the undeserving gather the spoils from me! When justice lies in spiked pit! When worth's measure is heredity. O Lord Feringal feeds at Meralda's neck. Fy this life and fly from me. He ended his impromptu verse by falling to his knees and clutching at his teary face, and there he wallowed for a long, long while. Anger replaced self-pity, and Jacka came up with a new line to finish his verse. When justice lies in spiked pit, he recited, his voice quivering with rage. When worth's measure is heredity. Now a smile crept onto his undeniably handsome features. Wretched Feringal feeds at Meralda's neck, but he'll not have her virginity. Jacka climbed unsteadily to his feet and looked up again at the full moon. I swear to it. He said with a growl, then muttered dramatically, "Fy this life!" One last time, and started for home. Meralda took the evening in stoic stride, answering questions politely and taking care to avoid the direct gaze of an obviously unhappy Lady Priscilla Auk. She found that she liked Steward Tamagast quite a bit, mostly because the old man kept the conversation moving by telling many entertaining stories of his past and of the previous lord of the castle, Feringal's father. Tamagast even set up a signal system with Meralda to help her understand which piece of silverware she should use for the various courses of food. Though she remained unimpressed with the young lord of Orkney, who sat directly opposite her and stared unceasingly, the young woman couldn't deny her wonder at the delicious feast the servants laid out before her. Did they eat like this every day in Castle Auk? Squab and fish, potatoes and sea greens, delicacies Meralda had never tasted before? At Lord Feringal's insistence, after dinner the group retired to the drawing room, a comfortable, windowless square chamber at the center of the castle's ground floor. Thick walls kept out the chill ocean wind, and a massive hearth, burning with a fire as large as a village bonfire, added to the coziness of the place.
"Perhaps he would like more food,"
Priscilla offered, but there was nothing generous about her tone.
"I can have a serving woman bring it in."
"Oh, no, my lady," Meralda replied. "I couldn't eat another morsel."
"Indeed," said Priscilla. "But you did overindulge at dinner proper now, didn't you?"
she asked, a sweet and phony smile painted on her ugly face. It occurred to Meralda that Lord Feringal was almost charming compared to his sister. Almost, A servant entered then, bearing a tray of snifters filled with a brownish liquid Miralda didn't recognize. She took her glass, too afraid to refuse, and on Temagast's toast and motion, she raised it up and took a healthy swallow. The young woman nearly choked from the burning sensation that followed the liquid down her throat.
"We don't take such volumes of brandy here," Priscilla remarked dryly. "That is a peasant trait."
Miralda felt like crawling under the thick rug. Crinkling his nose at her, Lord Feringal didn't help much.
"More a trait for one who is not familiar with the potent drink," Temagast interjected, coming to Miralda's aid. "Tiny sips, my dear. You will learn, though you may never acquire a taste for this unique liquor. I haven't yet myself."
Miralda smiled and nodded a silent thank you to the old man, which relieved the tension again, and not for the last time. Feeling a bit light in the head, Miralda faded out of the conversation, oblivious to Priscilla's double-edged remarks and Lord Feringal's stares. Her mind drifted off, and she was beside Jackus Schooley, in a moonlit field, perhaps, or this very room. How wonderful this place would be, with its thick carpet, huge fire, and this warming drink, if she had the companionship of her dear Jacka instead of the wretched Auk siblings. Temagast's voice penetrated her fog, reminding Lord Feringal that they had promised to return the young lady by a certain hour, and that the hour was fast approaching.
"A few moments alone, then,"
Feringal replied. Miralda tried not to panic.
"Hardly a proper request," Priscilla put in.
She looked at Miralda and snickered.
"Of course, what could possibly be the harm?"
Feringal's sister left, as did Temagast, the old steward patting Miralda comfortingly on the shoulder as he slipped past to the door.
"I trust you will act as a gentleman, my lord," he said to Feringal, "as your station demands. There are few women in all the wide world as beautiful as Lady Miralda."
He gave the young woman a smile.
"I will order the coach to the front door."
The old man was her ally, Miralda recognized, a very welcome ally.
"It was a wonderful meal, was it not?"
Lord Feringal asked, moving quickly to take a seat on the chair beside Miralda's.
"Oh, yes, my lord,"
she replied, lowering her gaze.
"No, no," Feringal scolded. "You must call me Lord Feringal, not my lord."
"Yes, my Lord Feringal."
Miralda tried to keep her gaze averted, but the man was too close, too imposing. She looked up at him, and to his credit, he did take his stare from her breasts and looked into her eyes.
"I saw you on the road," he explained. "I had to know you. I had to see you again. Never has there been any woman as beautiful."
"Oh, my Lord Feringal,"
she said. And she did look away again, for he was moving even closer, far too close by Miralda's estimate.
"I had to see you,"
he said again, his voice barely a whisper. But he was close enough that Miralda heard it clearly and felt his breath hot on her ear. Miralda fought hard to swallow her panic as the back of Feringal's hand brushed gently down her cheek. He cupped her chin then and turned her head to face him. He kissed her softly at first, then, despite the fact that she was hardly returning the kiss, more urgently, even rising out of his chair to lean into her. As he pressed and kissed, Miralda thought of Jacka and of her sick mother and tolerated it, even when his hand covered the soft fabric over her breast.
"Your pardon, Lord Feringal,"
came Temagast's voice from the door. Flushing, the young man broke away and stood up to face the steward.
"The coach is waiting," Temagast explained. "It is time for Lady Miralda to return to her home."
Miralda nearly ran from the room.
"I will call for you again,"
Lord Feringal said after her.
and soon, to be sure.
By the time the coach had moved over the bridge that separated Castle Auk from the mainland, Miralda had managed to slow her heartbeat somewhat. She understood her duty to her family, to her sick mother, but she felt as if she would faint or vomit. Wouldn't the wretch Priscilla have a grand time with that, if she found that the peasant had thrown up in the gilded coach? A mile later, still feeling sick and aching to be out of all these trappings, Miralda leaned out the coach window.
"Stop! Oh, please stop!"
she yelled to the driver. The carriage shuddered to a halt, but even before it had completely stopped, the young woman threw open the door and scrambled out.
"My lady, I am to take you to your home,"
Liam Woodgate said, leaping down to Miralda's side.
"And so you have,"
the woman replied.
"Close enough."
"But you've a long, dark lane before you,"
the gnome protested.
"Steward Temagast'll have my heart in his hand if—"
"He'll never know,"
Miralda promised.
"Don't fear for me. I walk this lane every night, and know every bush and rock and person in every house between here and my own."
"But—"
the gnome began to argue. But Miralda pushed past him, shot him a confident smile, and skipped away into the darkness. The coach shadowed her for a short while, then, apparently convinced the woman was indeed familiar enough with this area to be safe, Liam turned it around and sped away. The night was chill, but not too cold. Miralda veered from the road, moving to the dark fields higher up. She hoped to find Jacka there, waiting for her as they had arranged. But the place was empty. Alone in the dark, Miralda felt as if she were the only person in all the world. Anxious to forget tonight, to forget Lord Feringal and his wretched sister, she stripped off her gown, needing to be out of the fancy thing. Tonight she had dined as nobility, and other than the food and perhaps the warm drink, she had not been impressed, not in the least. Wearing only her plain undergarments, the young woman moved about the moonlit field, walking at first, but as thoughts of Jacka Schooley erased the too recent image of Lord Feringal, her step lightened to a skip, then a dance. Miralda reached up to catch a shooting star, spinning to follow its tail, then falling to her rump in the soft grass and mud, laughing all the while and thinking of Jacka. She didn't know that she was in almost exactly the same spot where Jacka had been earlier that night. The place where Jacka had spat his protests at an unhearing god, where he'd cried out against the injustice of it all, where he'd called for his life to flee, and where he'd vowed to steal Miralda's virginity for no better reason than to ensure that Lord Feringal did not get it. Chapter 5. Inside a Tight Frame.
"Where'd you put the darn thing?"
a frustrated Aram guard peck asked Josie Puddles the next afternoon.
"I know ye took it, so don't be lying to me."
"Be glad that I took it,"
an unrepentant Josie countered, wagging his finger in Aram's face.
"Wolfgar would have torn the whole place apart to kindling with that warhammer in his hands." "Bah, you're a fool, Josie Puddles,"
Aram replied.
"He'd have left without a fight."
"So ye're saying,"
Josie retorted.
"You're always saying such, always taking up the man's cause, though he's been naught but trouble to yourself and to all who've been loyal to ye. What good's Wolfgar done for ye, Aram Guardpeck? What good ever?"
Aram narrowed his eyes and stared hard at the man.
"And every fight he stopped was one he started,"
Josie added.
"Bah, he's gone, and good enough for him, and good enough for all of us."
"Where'd ye put the warhammer?"
Aram pressed again. Josie threw up his hands and spun away, but Aram wouldn't let him go that easily. He grabbed the little man by the shoulder and whipped him around violently.
"I asked ye twice already," he said grimly. "Don't ye make me ask again."
"It's gone,"
Josie replied.
"Just gone, and far enough so that Wolfgar couldn't call to the thing."
"Gone?"
Aram echoed. His expression grew sly, for he understood Josie better than to think the man had simply thrown so wondrous a weapon into the ocean.
"And how much did you get for it?"
Josie stuttered a protest, waved his hand, and stammered again, which only confirmed Aram's suspicions.
"Ye go get it back, Josie Puddles," the tavern keeper instructed.
Josie's eyes widened. "Cannot," he started to say, but Aram grabbed him by the shoulder and took the seat of his pants and ushered him along toward the door.
"Go get it back,"
Aram said again, no room for debate in his stern tone. "And don't come back to me until ye got the hammer in hand."
"But I cannot,"
Josie protested.
"Not with that crew." "Then you're not welcome here anymore,"
Aram said, shoving Josie hard through the door and out into the street.
"Not at all, Josie Puddles. You come back with a hammer or you don't come back."
He slammed the door, leaving a stunned Josie out in the street. The skinny man's eyes darted around, as if he expected some thugs to step out and rob him. He had good cause for concern. Aram's cutlass was Josie's primary affiliation, and in a sense, his source of protection on the streets. Few bothered with Josie, mostly because he wasn't worth bothering with, but mainly because troubling Josie would shut down all routes to the cutlass, a favorite place. Josie had made more than a few enemies on the street, and once word spread that he and Aram had fallen out, he had to get back in Aram's favor. But when he considered the necessary task before him, his knees went weak. He had sold Aegis Fang cheaply to a nasty pirate in a wretched drinking hole, a place he visited as rarely as possible. Josie's eyes continued to dart all around, surveying Half Moon Street and the alleys that would take him to the private and secret drinking hole by the docks. Sheila Cree would not be there yet, he knew. She would be at her ship, Leaping Lady. The name referred to the image of Sheila Cree leaping from her ship to that of her unfortunate victims, bloody saber in hand. Josie shuddered at the thought of meeting her on the very dark deck where she was known to have tortured dozens of innocent people to horrible deaths. No, he decided. He would wait to meet with her at the drinking hole, a place a bit more public. The little man fished through his pockets. He still had all the gold Sheila had paid him for Aegis Fang, and a couple of his own coins as well. He hardly thought it enough. But with Aram's friendship at stake, he had to try.
"It's wonderful to be with ye,"
Deli Curti said, running her hand over Wolfgar's huge bare shoulder, which drew a wince from the big man. That shoulder, like every other part of his body, had not escaped the battering at the cutlass. Wolfgar muttered something unintelligible and rose from the bed, and while Deli's hands continued to caress him, he continued to ignore the touch.
"Are ye sure ye're wanting to leave already?"
the woman asked in a seductive manner. Wolfgar turned to regard her, stretching languidly on the rumpled bed.
"Yeah, I'm sure," he grumbled, as he pulled on his clothes and headed for the door.
Deli started to call out after him, but bit back her begging. She started to scold him, but bit that back too, understanding the futility of it all, and knowing that her own harsh words wouldn't cover her hurt. Not this time. She had gone to Wolfgar the previous night, as soon as Aram closed his doors, which was not long after the fight had scuttled the cutlass. Deli knew where to find the now homeless man, for Morik kept a room nearby. How thrilled she had been when Wolfgar had taken her in, despite Morik's protests. She had let her guard back down again, for Deli had spent the night in Wolfgar's arms, fantasizing about escaping her miserable life with the heroic man. They could run away from Luskin, perhaps, and back to wild Icewind Dale, where she might raise his children as his proper wife. Of course, the morning, or rather the early afternoon, had shown her the truth of those fantasies in the form of a grumbling rejection. She lay on the bed now, feeling empty and alone, helpless and hopeless. Though things between her and Wulfgar had been hurtful of late, the mere fact that the man was still around had allowed her to hold on to her dreams. If Wulfgar wouldn't be around anymore, Delhi would be without any chance of escape.
"Did you expect anything different?" came a question from Morik, as if the rogue were reading her mind.
Delhi gave him a sad, sour look.
"You must know by now what to expect from that one," Morik reasoned, moving to sit on the bed.
Delhi started to pull the covers up, but remembered that it was just Morik, and he knew well enough what she looked like.
"He will never give you that which you truly desire," Morik added. "Too many burdens clouding his mind. Too many remembered agonies. If he opened up to you as you hope, he'd likely kill you by mistake."
Delhi looked at him as if she didn't understand. Hardly surprised, Morik merely smiled and said again,
"He'll not give you that which you truly desire."
"And will Morik, then?"
Delhi asked with open sarcasm. The rogue laughed at the thought.
"Hardly," he admitted. "But at least I tell you that openly. Except for my word, I am no honest man and want no honest woman. My life is my own, and I don't wish to be bothered with a child or a wife."
"Sounds lonely."
"Sounds free," Morik corrected with a laugh. "Ah, Delhi," he said, reaching up to run a hand through her hair, "you would find life so much more enjoyable if you basked in present joys without fearing for future ones."
Delhi Curti leaned back against the headboard, considering the words and showing no practical response against them. Morik took that as a cue and climbed into the bed beside her.
"I'll give you this part, me squeaky little friend, for your offered coins," the rowdy Sheila Cree said, tapping the flat of Aegis Fang's head. She exploded into a violent movement that brought the warhammer arcing over her head to smash down on the center of a table separating her from Josie Puddles.
Suddenly, Josie realized with great alarm that there was only empty air between him and the vicious pirate, for the table had collapsed to splinters across the floor. Sheila Cree smiled wickedly and lifted Aegis Fang. With a squeak, Josie sprinted for and through the door, out into the wet, salty night air. He heard the explosion behind him, the hurled hammer connecting solidly against the jamb, heard the howls of laughter from the many cutthroats within. Josie didn't look back. In fact, by the time he stopped running, he was leaning against the wall of the cutlass, wondering how in the nine hells he was going to explain the situation to Aram. He was still gasping to regain a steady breath when he spotted Delhi moving fast down the road, her shawl pulled tight around her. She would not normally be returning to the cutlass so late, for the place was already brimming with patrons, unless she were on an errand from Aram. Her hands were empty, except for the folds of the shawl, so Josie had little trouble figuring out where she had gone, or at least who she had gone to visit. As she neared, the little man heard her sobs, which only confirmed that Delhi had gone to see Wulfgar, and that the barbarian had ripped her heart open a bit wider.
"Are ye all right?"
the man asked, moving out to intercept the woman. Delhi jumped in surprise, aware that Josie had been standing there.
"What pains ye?"
Josie asked softly, moving closer, lifting his hands to pat Delhi's shoulders and thinking that he might use this moment of pain and vulnerability to his own gain, to finally bed the woman about whom he had fantasized for years. Delhi, despite her sobs and downcast expression, abruptly pulled away from him. The look she returned was not one of lust, not even of friendship.
"He hurt ye, Delhi,"
Josie remarked quietly and comfortingly.
"He hurt ye, and I can help ye feel better."
Delhi scoffed openly.
"Ye're the one who set it all up, aren't ye now, Josie Puddles?
he accused. "What a happy sot ye are for chasing Wulfgar away!" Before Josie could begin to answer, the woman brushed past him and disappeared into the cutlass, a place where Josie could not follow. He stood out in the empty street, in the dark of night, with no place to go and no friends to speak of. He blamed Wulfgar for all of it. Josie Puddles spent that night wandering the alleyways and drinking holes of the toughest parts of Luskin. He spoke not a word to anyone through the dark hours, but instead listened carefully, always on the alert in these dangerous parts. To his surprise, he heard something important and not threatening. It was an interesting story concerning Morik the Rogue and his large barbarian friend.